From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump answered reporters' questions before boarding Air Force One to travel to storm-ravaged Florida and Georgia. Asked about the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Trump said he spoke with the King of Saudi Arabia.
The King firmly denied any knowledge of it. He didn't really know. Maybe, I don't want to get into his mind, but it sounded to me like maybe these could have been rogue killers. Who knows?
President Trump also said he's sending Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to Saudi Arabia. Let's kick off the week ahead in politics with NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Good morning, or good afternoon. How are you? Sorry.
Hello. We'll start with the missing Saudi journalist. The president picking up on a theory that your colleague, NPR's Jackie Northam, told us is popular in Saudi Arabia. This was rogue killers. But in a consulate, you know, even Republican lawmakers want punishment that the president seems unwilling to carry out in blocking an arms deal. What's your sense of what's going to happen here?
Well, it's certainly complicated geopolitically for this president. He seems to have revealed himself pretty plainly as somebody who wants to talk about, you know, specific transactions. You know, he's a very transactional person. This is the way he was with his real estate deals. And the thing that kept coming up for President Trump was the fact last night on 60 Minutes that he said, look, we get billions of dollars in these weapon sales, and he doesn't want to hurt jobs when it comes to Raytheon or any of the other arms makers.
Well, and as others have said, these aren't really commitments for sales. They're more like promissory notes. You know, they may not happen anyway. But and some of them also did happen under the Obama administration. But you mentioned the 60 Minutes interview. He was also asked about that dire report from the intergovernmental agencies claiming that climate change is real and time is running out to do something about it. The president said he's not denying that climate change exists, but that it could change back. And that people say that storms, as we just saw with Hurricane Michael, were worse years ago. Let's listen to his conversation with Leslie Stahl.
They say that we had hurricanes that were far worse than what we just had with Michael.
Who says that? They say.
You mean people say that in the...
Yeah, but what about the scientists who say it's worse than ever?
You'd have to show me the scientists because they have a very big political agenda.
Domenico?
Well, climate change is real. That's a thing that we've had to say
over and
over again.
I'm not asking you to defend it, right?
but this is a president who, again, is very transactional. He's not somebody who's very interested in the long view or the science. He's interested in making sure that the economy stays where it is so that it benefits him politically. And I think, again, that's what we continue to see and continue to talk about. He's not somebody with a vision for the globe as much as he is somebody who's trying to win the next battle and move on. And it's something that he talked about even with the Brett Kavanaugh fight that they won. And that's why he went and talked about Christine Blasey Ford the way he did, because it was about winning. And now he's moved on from that.
Going through our smorgasbord here, the New York Times reporting that the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, dodged income tax for years. He, of course, has a crucial advisory role in the White House. And that comes after the Times also reported on how the Trump family used schemes to avoid taxes for decades. Look, Democratic lawmakers have amplified their calls for the president to release his tax returns. Any sense that might happen?
You know, it's possible if Democrats take control of the House that they could try to force the president to do that through the IRS or through the Treasury, and the IRS is within the Treasury. There are some machinations for Democrats to be able to at least try to wage that fight. Whether or not the Treasury actually goes along with it would be a different thing. Politically, though, whether this will make any difference, I'm highly skeptical because, you know, the president has a long history of, you know, avoiding income tax through various legal loopholes. And when he was asked on the campaign trail about that, he said, what does that make me? It makes me smart.
Yeah. Look, we want to get to Elizabeth Warren releasing the DNA test that provides strong evidence she has Native American ancestry dating back 6 to 10 generations. Of course, President Trump has mocked that claim. Our listeners are pointing out that Trump's own family immigrated from Germany. And after World War II, all of them, including Donald Trump, claimed they were Swedes in order to sell homes to Jewish people. That's pretty well documented. So perhaps hypocrisy on the part of the president. But is Warren doing this because of 2020?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question about that. I think that this is a typical strategy, follows a pattern when you have your most vulnerable thing that you need to get out there and addressed. She's doing it 3 weeks before an entirely different election when a whole lot of people are going to be, the day that the election results are known, talking about 2020. I think there's no clearer sign that she's running than what she did today.
NPR political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Trump is in Florida today visiting communities devastated by Hurricane Michael. And one of the worst hit places is Panama City, where Brittany Cole and her family lost their home to heavy winds and flooding. They're now staying with relatives while they figure out what to do next. Brittany, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, how are you and your family holding up?
There are moments that that we just break down. I mean, we have been given so many things by so many people and offered support and all these amazing things. But then there are the moments that we sit and realize that everything that we've built and done, you know, as a family at this home is gone, and not including our communities, the places we love are gone.
And you and your family were actually in the home when the storm hit.
Yes, I'm a Floridian. You know, we've ridden out hurricanes before. I rode out Hurricane Opal back when I was 8 years old. So we stayed and we were watching out the door. I was watching my fence go, which then I kind of got scared because I'm thinking, why is our fence going? And then my pear tree went, and then like a giant oak started to go. So I took our toddler and my grandmother and my mother and went and hid in the closet or in the bathroom. Uh-huh. And my husband held the front door shut to our home from the inside, and my grandfather held the back door so that way the hurricane wouldn't come through there, blow that, you know, all up, and then tear the roof completely off the house to save our lives, basically.
And what happened to the house?
My daughter's bedroom's completely gone. Our roof is basically gone. It's still like sitting there, but there's nothing else to it besides it. It's sitting there. Our house is pretty much an entire loss. We've had water everywhere. All of our furniture, everything like that is gone. We've salvaged what little bit of clothes. I work in medical marketing, so I grabbed my scrubs. My husband grabbed his law enforcement uniforms. And then we tried to come back the following days and get anything that we can. But it's getting more and more dangerous because it just keeps collapsing every time we go in there.
And your husband's a police officer. So has he been having to respond to emergencies elsewhere?
He is actually at a shelter right now. So he is helping residents, try to get their lives back together. And he's at a shelter. But of course, if there's an emergency, then he has to respond if he gets called out somewhere else.
Do you have the basic supplies that you need at this point?
We do. Thankfully, we've had family and friends that have gathered around us to get us everything we need. And we joke because I buy in bulk and it drives my husband nuts. Mm-hmm. But in this case, since it was in the garage, we have enough shampoo and everything. He's thankful that I'm, bought in bulk at that point.
Wow. Wow.
We have basic necessities.
How much help are you getting from the government right now? We've seen the politicians there, state politicians. President Trump is in the area today. Are you getting what you need from state and federal government?
We haven't received any federal assistance. I've applied for FEMA. I was on the phone with them till late last night, so we haven't received anything. We're trying to get assistance because our home, we're being jerked around by our insurance companies. We had two to cover our home in case of a situation like this, and now both of them are trying not to pay us. So we're trying really hard to hold on to something good, and hopefully FEMA is going to come through and help us.
After this experience, and you said you've been through Opal as well, that was back in 1995, do you feel like leaving the area?
No, absolutely not. We will not leave. This is home for us. I grew up here. I went to high school here and everything else. And we're not going to leave. We're going to help rebuild. As soon as we figure out our situation and what we're going to do, then we're going to get to work on someone else's needs and help them. So we're not leaving.
What's it like to walk around there right now?
A war zone. We have people, and I know a lot of rumors have gone around, especially since people don't have cell service. But, there are a ton of looters. There's looters everywhere. I know police shot one at least. So there's been looters. People are afraid. You know, at night there's no lights whatsoever. It's completely dark. So people are having to go to sleep with their gun right next to them because they don't know if someone's going to try to enter their home or not. So it's scary. And we're beating daylight every single day because I get up, try to go to our house, get, like today I'm going to get dishes. Thankfully I have help coming from Dallas, Texas. They're coming to help me get dishes out of the house, and then we're going to shut it up and be done with our house. What little bit is left if it doesn't collapse fully.
That's Brittany Cole. She and her family, including a three-year-old daughter, are in Panama City recovering from Hurricane Michael. They lost their home. Brittany, thank you so much, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
An important story, and we will continue to follow the recovery from Hurricane Michael.
And now a look at some of the latest technology for the blind and the vision impaired with our friend and go-to guy, Brian Charlson, Director of Technology at the Carroll Center for the Blind. And Brian, you have all sorts of things spread out here in the studio, and we're making a video so people can see this for their loved ones. We'll post it at hearnow.org. But what would you like to start with?
I'm going to start with the simplest of technologies, one that has a lot of impact on blind or visually impaired people, and that is our ability to take the right medicine at the right time.
You got a medicine bottle.
I've got
in
a medicine
hands.
Bottle here, and attached to its side is a little digital recorder. Now there's kind of a comical recording on here.
Abraham Lincoln, Xanax. Take one pill every 4 hours as needed. Prescription number 21.
Wow, what a great thing!
Instead of having to put rubber bands on to indicate whether or not this is a once a day or twice a day or three times a day med, I can rely on this kind of labeling.
That is amazing. First of all, who knew that Abraham Lincoln had a prescription?
Yeah, for Xanax. Yeah. Now, this is one example of two or three different companies out there. The one that I tend to get my medications from is a mail order place. But I can also get this from just down the street at the local pharmacy.
Great. Okay.
So that's that. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of people these days are having to deal with diabetes, mm-hmm. as am I. And therefore, you have to take your blood sugar on a regular basis.
You have to test it.
So I've just taken a test strip out, and I'm going to slide it into my glucose monitor.
Thank you for using Prodigy Voice.
She's just acknowledging this, and that's just going
to
tell me,
please apply blood to the test strip.
So I could prick my finger, put the blood on there, and it will tell me my blood sugar.
Wow.
And it keeps track of it over time. Yeah, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
It keeps track of it over time so that when I go to see my physician, they can download the data from it.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
okay.
Also in my little bag over here, I love the kitchen. In my household, it's my favorite room. I love to cook. And so I'm forever looking for gadgets that will make my life easier. So in my kitchen, I have a talking microwave oven. I have a talking kitchen scale so that when I'm baking, I can measure by weight rather than by volume, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a talking thermometer. I like this one because, among other things, pushing a button a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. 81.0 degrees Fahrenheit.
This I can switch from Fahrenheit to centigrade, and it can take very high temperatures. I'm now taking out of my bag they're called a dot, part of the Echo family. And in my household, we have a big Echo in the living room and little dots here and there throughout the house.
Let's be honest, Brian. I don't want your wife to hear this, but you do refer to this as your new girlfriend.
It is, yes. Echo is definitely my new girlfriend. The fact of the matter is that she wakes me up in the morning. She sings me to sleep at night. Sounds like a girlfriend to me.
Brian, what is life like? I mean, there's so many more devices. We want to see them. But I'm just wondering what life is like in your house with these. This is a revolution for you. But I'm also thinking that there's just got to be voices going all the time. You talking to Alexa and asking her to turn a light on or off, or turn, you know, the radio on or off, or, you know, testing your blood. Or it feels like there's a Greek chorus following you.
There's a lot of chatter that goes on in the house, no doubt. I'm very lucky that I know Braille. So A portion of my access to information comes tactily, so nobody gets to hear what's going on. But one of the absolute phenomenons in my household is I get out of bed first, head to the bathroom. I turn on the shower, the sink, flush the toilet, and step onto my talking scale. Because I don't want the rest of the household to hear what the bad news of the morning is from that talking scale. So we learn to mask it, we control volume, and with the new Echo family, only the one closest to you responds. So you don't have this problem of saying something down the hallway, only have it change something in the living room.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Got it. Okay.
I mentioned Braille a moment ago. Mm-hmm. Now, Braille hasn't been around that long, just a couple of hundred years, and it's still under development. We recently adopted an international standard for English Braille because the Brits wrote Braille differently than the Americans, than did the Australians. But the big change in Braille is what's called refreshable Braille. I'm going to turn on this Orbit Reader.
Mm-hmm. It looks like a handheld label printer. What's it doing?
Little dots, electromechanical dots, are raising up in the pattern of Braille characters. Now, a couple of years ago, I was showing you a refreshable Braille display,
right,
and you were astounded at the price of $3,000 to $4,000. This one now costs $500.
Oh, wow.
So Braille is becoming more affordable than it's ever been before. And now I'm going to turn to magnification.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of blind or visually impaired people have usable vision. So out of those who are legally blind, about 8 out of 10 have some usable vision. So we use closed-circuit television devices. I'm going to turn this one on.
Mm-hmm. It looks like a very small TV.
Yep. Did it come on?
Yep.
It gives me controls to show things in magnification, to increase the magnification, decrease it, change the polarity of things. So if I see things better white on black than black on white, then fine, I can switch that.
Mm-hmm.
I can also take a picture with it at a distance, bring it closer to my face, and be able to control that magnification as well. And if you do have a large TV in your living room, you can attach this to that and use its screen, but the device that's on your, the camera that's on your device.
Right. And really enlarge an image. That's
yep.
great.
So grandparents with low vision can see pictures of their grandkids.
Yeah.
So this makes it very portable for them to do that
Wonderful.
Kind of thing.
We know you have Catch the Bus. That's an application that can help you find bus stops, learn arrival departure times. Blind Square, that's a GPS application just like Foursquare. But I want to see the device that helps you know the color of your clothing.
Ah. So the color identifier that I brought to show you last time cost $350.
Right.
This one costs $26.
Wow.
And this is maybe a tenth the size of that one.
Yeah, it's like a car key fob.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to hold it against my tie.
Dark orange.
Dark orange. That's right.
Dark red.
Dark red stripes.
Dark beige.
Dark beige.
Very dark brown.
Wow.
Now, I'm pointing it at my pants and they say,
very dark brown.
Very dark brown. That's lying. I'm wearing
I'm looking under the
black
table.
Pants.
Oh,
correct?
Okay.
And
very dark brown.
Yeah.
That tells me, guess what? The battery's dying.
Oh.
When it gets that far off.
Wow.
So I now match my own pants with shirts, with ties in my household, something that I always had to rely on somebody else to do in the past.
I want to see the glasses that you can get help with.
So I'm going to take off my regular designer shades here and put on a pair of glasses. But they have a camera mounted just above the nose.
No way.
So I'm now going to take a phone. It's specifically a Verizon phone that has only one purpose, and that's to do what I'm about to do with it.
Hello, Brian. Ira ready for service.
And now, if I double tap on the home button on this phone, it's calling an Ira agent.
Connecting to agent. Connecting to agent Cody.
Thanks for calling, Ira. This is Cody. How can I help you?
Hey, Cody. Brian here. I'm doing a demonstration of Ira for public radio.
Hi, Cody.
And across the way here is my interviewer, And can you do me a favor? Describe the pretty lady.
Sure, definitely. So I do see her. She is across the table, facing, you know, in the direction the camera's facing.
Okay, Cody, you're freaking me out.
looks like she is waving currently with her right hand.
Am I waving to your glasses?
She's waving to you.
Yes.
She's wearing like a white, almost like a jacket with a collar. Looks like she's wearing glasses and has a kind of a headset on as well.
How do you do?
Cody, you did pretty well.
There you go.
Hey, Cody, can I just ask a question?
Sure.
What kinds of situations do you usually deal with? Like, just if you can give us a couple of examples. I'm sure people get in real trouble and need your help.
A lot of ways that people use IRA is just for little things that, you know, sighted people sometimes take for granted, like reading cooking instructions or really just reading mail, for instance. There's a lot of things, just little things like that, that people use IRA for. And that's probably one of the main ways IRA makes a difference in their lives.
Well, thank you so much for being part of our demonstration.
Right. One of the ways I've used IRA, my family and I were at a Red Sox game that unfortunately got rained out, and I needed an Uber ride. So Uber can be connected up to your IRA account, and the IRA agent ordered me an Uber vehicle, helped direct me to where the vehicle could pick me up, and then kept an eye on how the vehicle was progressing getting to me. So the IRA agent literally kept an eye out for me.
Look, as usual, Brian, you have opened our eyes with this technology. We appreciate it so much. We've made a video so people can, you know, show it to their loved ones and who are sighted. And actually, those who aren't can hear this terrific sound that you've brought us. And I just can't wait till next time already. Brian Charlson, Director of Technology at the Carroll Center for the Blind, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, that IRA service, which just blew me away, cost about 90 cents a minute to use. Again, we'll have all this information at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Sears filed for bankruptcy today after failing to make a $134 million debt payment. It's an inglorious chapter for the 125-year-old retailer whose parking lots and Sunday hours revolutionized consumer culture after World War II. Sears is expected to close 142 stores by the end of the year, but says it hopes to keep most of its profitable ones open. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So Sears Holding Corporation, which also owns Kmart, is probably going to be giving out a lot of pink slips over the coming months. How many employees are at risk of losing their jobs?
Somewhere in the neighborhood of nearly 70,000. Wow. And it is unclear what's going to happen. Remember, this is a time when brick and mortar positions for retailers are dwindling and online behemoths. I'm looking at you, Amazon. They're going on somewhat of a hiring spree. So maybe these folks would go towards the online departments that in many of the other retailers. They certainly are paying more, up to $15 an hour.
But not all of the Sears stores are going to close.
Yeah, actually, the company had nearly 900 stores as of August 4th. That's what we pulled from a recent public filing. But as you said at the top, in its bankruptcy, it said it's going to close 142 more stores by the end of the year. That's after already announcing a round of 46 store closures. And it's frankly not clear which locations are going to be closed at this point.
So a lot of bad news for a lot of people. Is there anybody who wins from what's going on?
I don't know. I mean, I'd hate to say there are winners.
But there are people that are probably going to make money on this.
Yes, of course, because they are going to they have bought distressed debt, or they are the financial engineers on whom the management had really relied to come around and rescue them. But I think that, really, yes, there are going to be investors who make some money. There will be some vultures who can buy liquidated assets at very, you know, pennies on the dollar potentially. But frankly, there are far more losers than winners, and none more so than the people who work there and the people who shop there.
Do you see a path forward for Sears? Will it ever come back?
You know, I would look and say that retailers have just not had a great track record of emerging from bankruptcy. Look at Toys R Us, for example. It was forced to liquidate. Look, it's hard to make changes like investing in e-commerce or stores or even a company's brand while you're catering to your creditors' demands and also, more importantly, while you are really trying to face this massive competition.
We think of so many things when we think of Sears, those catalogs. I guess there were also pre-cut kit houses, which in North Carolina still make up the majority of some towns. What's Sears going to be remembered for, at least the Sears that we know now? Maybe there will be a Sears in the future that is known for something else.
You know, I actually think not only the catalog, but all those different ancillary brands, and whether it's Land's End being one of them. You know, some of these brands really meant a lot to people. And think about this. Sears was the everything store before Amazon or even the internet existed. And in its heyday, check this out, half of American families had a Sears credit card. They employed over 500,000 people, and they were supposedly responsible for, get this, 2% of the GDP of the United States.
And they had their name on the tallest building in America, the Sears Indeed. Tower, which is now the Willis Tower. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, thank you.
Take care.
Back to President Trump's comments last night on 60 Minutes, continuing to question the importance of addressing climate change.
Look, I think something's happening, something's changing, and it'll change back again. I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made. I will say this. I don't want to give trillions and trillions of dollars. I don't want to lose millions and millions of jobs. I don't want to be put at a disadvantage.
Well, others are pushing forward. In fact, they say fighting climate change can be job-producing and that we're running out of time. According to last week's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, there's just about a decade left to take unprecedented action to reduce the extreme impacts of climate change. The report recommends reducing current emissions being released into the atmosphere, but also capturing the carbon dioxide that's already up there, what's known as negative emissions. Let's take a look with Gregory Nemeth, professor of public affairs and environmental studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor, technologies will be needed to do this, but one of the easiest ways to get carbon dioxide out of the air is plants, right? Because they just suck it out.
Yeah, so growing things, so using photosynthesis to take CO2 out of the atmosphere and then store it into wood in a tree or in plants, that has the potential to remove billions of tons of CO2 from the atmosphere. So that's really appealing. All of these schemes to remove CO2 have negatives, have some concerns about them. And the biggest one with planting more trees is that if you're planting trees, that's land that potentially could have been done something else with. And yeah. if that something else is growing food, that's a real concern, because that's one of the biggest impacts of climate change is worrying about crop yields in the future. And if we're going to have food prices go up because we're using land for food and using it to store CO2, that's a negative effect. So mm-hmm. even things like growing trees that we think are pretty benign have negative impacts because the scale has to be so large.
Well, and also we know that trees only store carbon for so much or so long. It may not be long enough.
Yeah, there's a permanence issue with storing CO2 in trees that is not such an issue if you're storing it underground, for example. That's
okay, so let's move on to some of the other ideas. Carbon capture, storage, what are some of the ideas there?
So the idea with carbon capture traditionally has been you take a power plant that's using fossil fuels, and instead of venting the CO2 into the atmosphere, which is what we do now, you find a way to collect it in the flue gas and compress it, put it in a pipeline, and store it underground. So that's a way to avoid CO2 going into the atmosphere. with negative emissions, there's a way you can actually remove CO2 to the atmosphere using that scheme by, again, planting crops. And instead of using the crops for food, you would use them for energy. So you take CO2 that's in the atmosphere, photosynthesis will store that CO2 into the crops. Then you burn the crops in a power plant. And instead of putting that CO2 back into the atmosphere, you're going to do the same thing, compress it and store it underground. And that has the potential to remove billions of tons of CO2. And in this case, store it underground where it tends to be more stable and will stay there as long as we need it to. It has a similar negative side effect that we had with planting trees in that you need to use farmland for growing those crops. So if we're using that land for crops that we're going to use to store CO2 and put it underground, we're not using that for food. And again, that could create food security issues, which is something we want to avoid.
Well, what about, and by the way, we just read Steven Pinker's terrific and provocative new book, Enlightenment Now. And, you know, he talks about the fact that a lot of this is going to be on technologies that we aren't, you know, we don't even have yet that are going to come along. But what about just sucking it right out of the air?
Yeah, I mean, that's an appealing one to do as well. So this is using chemical processes. And, you know, we've already been doing this on things like submarines or spacecraft where you need to remove the CO2 the humans are generating just by breathing. And so the idea is, could we do that at an industrial scale and capture CO2 that's in the air, capture that CO2, compress it, and then store it underground? That is appealing. One of the most appealing aspects of that is it doesn't have this large land impact that almost every other one of the schemes has. The biggest downside so far has been it's been dismissed as prohibitively expensive.
Right.
So something like three or four times as expensive as these other schemes.
Climeworks is a Swiss startup, and they say the costs are between 600 and 800 per metric ton of CO2 captured. There's another company in Canada that puts it closer to 250 per metric ton, but that's expensive.
That's expensive. And just to put that into comparison, if you looked at kind of the average price of CO2 over the whole world now, I think a number of about $5 is about right. There's other places it's high, like in Sweden and in the EU, you've got prices in $20 to $30. But overall, it's about $5. So that's way higher, like by a factor of 100. But I think what's interesting about those technologies is the costs have come down. So as you say, Climeworks did this first, the world's first demonstration plant about a year ago, and that was $600 per ton of CO2. Their next plants, they're saying they can do for between $100 and $150 per ton of CO2. There's another company called Carbon Engineering in Canada that thinks it can do it for about $100 to $200. There's a U.S. company called Global Thermostat that is doing its first demonstration in Alabama this year, and they think that will be about $150 per ton, and they have plans to get it down to $100 after that. So this idea that the cost of technology makes it impossible and we should just dismiss it, it seems to be falling away as we look at some of these real plants being built without severe problems and with costs that seem to be starting to come down. So there's a potential to really get the cost down, to make it affordable and not have the land use impacts. One of the biggest concerns that I would have is to do this in a real way, we need to be removing billions of tons of CO2 by mid-century. And so we need to be doing this on a large scale pretty soon. Right now, so there's three companies we've mentioned. That's it for the whole world in terms of commercial direct air capture. And I think that adds up to about 400 people in the world employed by these companies. But that really doesn't fit with the scale of the challenge we're facing. So that's the real challenge for direct air capture, is how you scale up from three companies doing on the order of five or six plants to something like 600,000 plants, which is what we're going to need in the next 5 or 10 years.
Oh, wow, 600,000. Well, you get investors excited about that. You know, that's maybe the future. But look, again, Steven Pinker writes, the more speculative end of this kind of thinking includes plans to disperse pulverized rock that takes up CO2 as it weathers, to add alkali to clouds or the oceans to dissolve more CO2 in the water, fertilize the ocean with iron to accelerate photosynthesis by plankton, and again, suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere in different ways. What do you say, though, to Howard Herzog, a fellow of Steven Pinker's at MIT, who says, in effect, that there's a danger that this might lead to complacency in reducing CO2 emissions if people start thinking, well, we're just going to scrub it out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, there is this concern, and it's sometimes called, the jargony term for it is moral hazard, this idea that if you have this technology available, it's kind of like an insurance policy, and then you'll engage in risky behavior. And in this case, it means you won't reduce emissions enough. I actually think we don't really have the luxury of dismissing this negative emissions technology as something that will take away our incentives. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, an insurance policy for house insurance or fire insurance or something like that, where, yeah, maybe there is a sense in which if you have the insurance, you'll be less careful about fires in your house. But on the other hand, most people still want to have insurance because it's worth it to them and it's worth it to society. And I think that's kind of the way we have to look at it. I think the other thing is, you know, we're not reducing emissions enough already, even without talking about negative emissions. So I think to say that the reason we're not reducing emissions is because we've got this breakthrough technology that we can use in the future, I don't think that's really what's limiting us. And I don't think it'll be enough just to have the negative emissions. So we really need both. We need to do the work of reducing emissions that go into the atmosphere and at the same time start deploying on a larger scale these negative emissions technologies.
It's Gregory Nemeth, a professor of public affairs and environmental studies at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Nemeth, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to be looking a lot at the latest big thoughts on how to address climate change for as long as it takes. You're listening to Here and Now.
It's been nearly 5 months since a gunman killed 10 people at Santa Fe High School in Texas. Among the victims was substitute teacher Cynthia Tisdale. She was also a full-time caregiver for her husband, William W.R. Tisdale, who was diagnosed with a life-threatening lung disease. Well, we got the sad news last week that W.R. Tisdale has died. His funeral is today. We spoke in May, shortly after he lost his wife, Cynthia.
It's been the most difficult time of my life. I never, ever expected to lose my wife. We the night before she was shot, we were making funeral arrangements for me because I've got this lung disease, and it's just one of those things you never, ever thank your wife or anyone you know is going to be shot killed the way she was.
When you mention your lung disease, this is idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Right.
Yes.
And your wife was trying to raise money for you before she died.
Correct.
I know that ever since she passed away and more attention has been brought, you've raised a lot of money.
Yes, and I'm going to go someday this week call the Lung Institute in Dallas and get the procedure started. I've been told it works, and I've been told it doesn't work. But I do know if I don't at least try it, I probably may make it through the end of the year, and that's about it. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's, you know, it's worth a try. I mean, I can't lose.
What do you think Cynthia would be telling you to do right now about this?
I'm sorry. Let me grab myself together. She would be setting an appointment for me. She was the one that took care of me and cared for me. Also, the night before this happened, I was extremely ill. And she came home and looked at me and said, "You don't look well." I said, "Well, honey, I don't feel like eating." So she opened a can of soup, chicken noodle, sat on the floor by my chair, and spoon-fed me. And she made me eat near that whole can. She was exceptionally good to me. I mean, almost 47 years.
Well, and she left you a note that morning, right?
Yeah, she did. I'll read it to you. My niece went to get it. And she wrote me a lot of notes. And I never saved them. I wish I would have. This one. She said I had to go meet a teacher. And I assume that's the other teacher that got killed. I love you. Hope you feel better today. Love, Mom. And I left you breakfast. And so I just left the note in the bathroom. And when I went into the kitchen, there was my breakfast. It just became a blur that day.
Yeah.
Until my son, Reese Jr., came over that night and told me. And we buried her. 1 week before her birthday, she was killed, and we buried her on her birthday.
There are a lot of people who are just hearing your story for the first time, just hearing about Cynthia for the first time. Okay. What would you want them to know? What message would you want to leave them with? People that you'll never meet, they'll never meet you in person, but what would you want them to know?
Well, she loved her husband. Loved her grandkids, loved her children. She was a lady that loved people in general. She was just that woman, you know, the one you read about that never gets any praise, but she should have been. I'll miss her, and many friends are going to miss her.
Well, she's getting some praise from you today, so that's good. W.R. Tisdale, husband of Cynthia Tisdale, substitute teacher who was killed in the shooting at Santa Fe High School on May the 18th. Our thoughts are with you and your family, and thank you so much for joining us and remembering Cynthia with us.
I sure appreciate the opportunity to say something good about it. Thank you so much.
I'm sure it's very, very, very difficult, and but it sounds like you're at least remembering all the good things about Cynthia, so that's good too.
Yeah, God has a way of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And He's done it for me.
Yeah. That conversation from May, W.R. Tisdale died last week. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young.